Resurrection Is Now by Dom L. Ridwatkin. The Moment of Choice. The moment of death is the moment when the human spirit comes face to face with its ultimate destiny, and when the feeble attempts we make in this life to, as we say, eat our cake and have it, can no longer continue. At death, the relative has to meet the absolute, and the time for blowing hot and cold, for partial acceptances and partial rejections, is now over. We must, therefore, now look at that great moment of choice which comes upon us at death, the moment when prevarication and indecision may no longer continue, and we have to choose or reject the absolute, absolutely. Judgment. When we come to think of judgment, it is inevitable that we have to make a mental or imaginative picture of what is totally outside our experience. It is right to do so, inasmuch as imagination is a reflection of that human experience which alone can make truth vivid to us. But it carries with it a great danger. Such imaginative pictures, whether based on metaphors or symbols from the scriptures or upon Christian art throughout the ages, can so obscure the reality that in rejecting the picture, we reject the truth. Or if we do not go so far as to reject entirely the truth, we can make the truth seem so odd or even repulsive that we do not allow it to intrude into the reality of our thoughts. It is as easy to do this with our judgment as to do it with regard to hell, heaven, or purgatory. We are so wedded to symbolic and imaginative expressions of these truths that we make the reality of them remote from ordinary living and fail to find a parallel with them in ordinary experience. So it is with judgment. As portrayed, it is a kind of external assessment by God which ends with a judicial sentence of condemnation or deliverance. It is hard to make this real to us. It seems to us that our evil has never been so absolute as to deserve such punishment, nor our good so disinterested as to deserve such reward. I think that if we consider this very real difficulty more carefully, we shall see that the real truth lies in an interiorization of this picture. We have to look at what is really meant, rather than at the way it is portrayed. Always, everywhere, and at all times, God has preserved man's freedom. His revelation of himself has never been such as to compel human assent to his existence. He has never forced man to act for his own good. Salvation has never been thrust upon him. But the moment comes when the relative meets the absolute, the changing and passing, the unchanging and the eternal, when faint intimations of beauty come face to face with beauty itself, when truths limited in scope and imperfectly understood meet naked truth itself. This is the judgment, or to use the gospel word, the crisis, of the whole of human life. It is the moment towards which the whole of human experience has been directed. All that has happened before, every moment of living, every insight, every appreciation of truth, every impulse of loving, every longing, and each and every striving leads irresistibly and inevitably to this. It is a moment that lies concealed at the heart of all moments that have gone before. Its grandeur, its hope, and its terror lie deep and unacknowledged at the roots of all human experience. Love has known it in the death and resurrection of its deepest moments. Knowledge has apprehended it as those times when truth is seen to be bigger than oneself. Faith has participated in it when it loses itself in the darkness of pure prayer. It is an agony and an ecstasy, that agony called by the poet the joyful agony of acceptance. Such pain and agony are inevitable and necessary, for they mark the process by which self-absorption and self-centeredness give way under the pressure of truth and love to the overwhelming and compulsive fact that what is true and that which is loved are larger than our limitations, cannot be given us on our own terms and must be accepted on theirs, that this giving of ourselves is a death which is the only way to resurrection. The moment of judgment, of crisis, is death, the moment when the mystery of ourselves meets the mystery of God. Illumined through and through by the pure light of truth, we can see ourselves for what we are. At the same time, we can, as it were, see before us the absolute, all beauty, all truth, all love. And we know as we are known. But this beauty, this truth, this love is not thrust upon us. We are not dragged forcibly into its depths. It stands before us as a challenge to be met, an invitation to be accepted. The Spirit and the Bride say, "Come." We may ask, what is to stand in our way? What is to prevent our coming? Can we fail to be drawn willingly into eternal happiness and complete and utter love and understanding? We should ask ourselves a further question. Do we even begin to comprehend what the invitation can mean at such a moment? It must mean, of course, an entire and complete commitment, the letting go of all that in us which we have up to the present so treasured and made our own, accepting it only as far as it has seemed beneficial or relevant to us. It means turning our hearts inside out, breaking down habits of thought, relinquishing completely our egotism, opening entirely and without reserve the inner citadel of ourselves. On an absolute level, it is that challenge to ourselves presented by love and truth of which we earlier spoke. And it is a judgment. The days of pretense and covering up are gone. Either we allow ourselves to be invaded totally and forever, lay open all that we have and are to be burnt in the fire of love and truth and accept the total totally, or we are so wedded to our own selfishness, so unable to see total good outside ourselves, so dismayed at this invitation to give to God every drop of the lifeblood that is in us, that we draw back in horror from such a total abandonment of ourselves as from something insane, suicidal, and not worth serious consideration. Thus is our judgment made. It is not our sins in themselves that could make us so draw back, for sinners who admit and reject their sin will be purified in purgatory. It is the sins to which we have become so habituated as to live always with them and cherish them as we would cherish ourselves. It is possible to arrive at a point when no good outside our selfishness can exist for us, to be turned in entirely upon ourselves as the only good. How real a possibility this is for each of us and for how many others, we cannot know. But that such a possibility exists, and that at certain times in our lives we have deserved it, we do know. Judgment is, then, not some external sentence imposed on us from without, but the inmost response of our whole being to the offer of absolute beauty, truth, love, and being. This offer is completely free from compulsion. It will be gladly accepted unless we have so conditioned ourselves that to us it is a meaningless invitation. Heaven is ours for the receiving. Purgatory. The fact of purgatory follows immediately from the fact of judgment. The completely real alone can meet the absolute. We have to give all to gain all. If we accept God's invitation to absolute truth, absolute love, and absolute beauty, we are laying ourselves open to be riven by truth to the division of soul and spirit, to be consumed in the fire of a love which sweeps through all we have and are, and to be seared by a beauty whose lightning flashes through us. All that exists in ourselves which is not loving, truthful, and beautiful, all our egotism, our lies, our pretences, our self-sufficiency, everything in us that we have withheld from God and his love, all that lies in those dark recesses of our being where holiness has not penetrated, all that is not fully responsive to the absoluteness of God will be burned up at the brightness of his coming. Into this purifying fire of love we will gladly plunge if we have chosen God at the moment of judgment, for we will be secure in the knowledge that only the good in us can meet the good of him, and we will be longing to be made clean and whole so that we may be fit to be with him. This purgation will be a pain, but its pain will be one that we shall gladly bear, that we shall long to bear, for we shall see in the light of unveiled truth how unprepared we yet are to let it illuminate us through and through. Our happy agony will be a longing for purification and our willing suffering to attain it. When we get outside the time cycle to which we are accustomed, we use symbolic expressions to explain truths in terms which we can understand. Most persons think of purgatory in terms of duration, of a period of purgation until the work of love is finished. But we can, with equal validity, think of it in terms of intensity and conceive of it as instantaneous. Each way of thinking is complementary to the other. What is clear is that the more that requires purification in us, the greater must be the intensity or duration of the purgation. God has given us his grace in sufficient abundance for us to complete this purification in this life, so that we could go as we are when we die straight into the vision of his glory. Unfortunately, most of us have not used fully this grace, and to a greater or less degree will need further purification before we can find ourselves able to dare to stand in God's presence. Our suffering in this life is, then, a powerful alchemy through which we can turn the lead in us, inert, soft, and dull, into gold refined by the fire. Any suffering willingly accepted as God's providence for us is a purifying one, and no moments in our lives need to be wasted. Moreover, those joys and ecstasies in life which spring from what is right and loving and good are equally part of our purgation. Nature itself leads towards it, and no human experience other than that which comes from selfishness and sin can lead us away from it. Purgatory, then, begins before death and continues after it. In this present life it is hard for us to see things as clearly and absolutely as we would wish. At death we shall know as we are known. We saw that full human love demands a kind of death in us, so completely does the acceptance of the absolute. It is an agony, for we have to let go everything that is not ourselves, to open up all those hidden corners and sealed-off reserves in us to the blinding light of God. It is a joy, for the pain is as nothing to the glory which is being revealed in us, the love that is sweeping ecstatically through us, and the beauty that is transforming us into itself. Hell. That the doctrine of hell presents great difficulties to many is very understandable. Most of these difficulties arise first from a feeling that evil wrought in time does not deserve an eternity of condemnation, and second, from a revulsion against a picture of fire and torment which seems so alien to a loving and merciful God. The first of these difficulties arises usually from the notion that the judgment all men have to face is like an arraignment before a legal tribunal which sentences men to reward or punishment. When we were thinking about judgment, we saw that there was no question of God not inviting everyone to enter into his glory, but that there was a possibility that some might not want to accept this invitation. In other words, no one is compelled to be with God who does not want to be. It may seem inconceivable to us that some persons should be so bound up with their own selfishness and self-indulgence that they are unable to see any good outside themselves so compelling as to make them relinquish all that they had hugged so long to themselves and had made their own private gods. Nevertheless, that in mind and heart a person can be so darkened, to use our Lord's phrase, that he cannot see any object at all in leaving all things and following Christ, must remain a genuine though we hope rare, possibility. What is certain is that God will not thrust his love and truth upon those unwilling to accept them. The host of heaven is not a conscript army. As we have just said, it might seem inconceivable that a person can be so wedded to sin that he cannot find meaningful any alternative to it. In fact, there are faint foretastes to be found in ordinary human experience. It is possible so to hug envy or resentment to oneself that despite the misery and frustration of it, one persists in this embrace of death. Again, as we noticed earlier, it is possible for a love to die in such a way that what was once full of meaning and significance, and which stirred us to the depths of our being, is now no longer the object of choice and means nothing at all to us. This experience of meaninglessness is like the mystery of sin, which, unrepented and encouraged, is like a mortal disease which eventually will kill the desire to choose good. What has no meaning to us cannot be the object of choice. Lust rejects pure love. Lies flee from truth. The hideous and obscene abhor beauty, and egotism shrinks in horror from all that would invade it. We may well feel that such a full determination to cling on to sin is rare, and we may hope that it is so, but the possibility of it must actually exist, unless we are to regard all men merely as puppets pulled by divine strings. The thought of the inexpressible holiness and majesty of God should make us humble enough to know that we are not dealing with an unreal situation, but with an actual possibility. Many find the picture of hell as a place of fire and torment intolerable to them. Like all pictures of what lies outside our experience, it portrays, if rightly understood, a very real truth. On many occasions our Lord talks of hell in terms of fire. This metaphor was partly taken from the valley below Jerusalem, where an undying fire burnt all the rubbish of the city, and partly because to those who live in a hot climate, fire and heat are natural metaphors for what is most to be dreaded. In the far north, for obvious reasons, the metaphors of ice and snow were employed for the same purpose. When we talk of metaphors, we are not saying that what they express is untrue, but simply that it is a way of portraying what it is impossible to describe. Let us consider the fate of those who reject eternally the eternal invitation of God, and who choose instead themselves and their sin. God does not set to work to punish them, but he will not interfere with their freedom and thwart their free choice. When we compare what they have chosen with the ecstasy that could have been theirs for the asking, the difference is so appalling that no metaphor can do it justice. What hell is in itself, we cannot and do not know, and we say nothing of those angelic spirits whose home is hell and whose object is destruction. Nevertheless, here again, ordinary experience can give us some faint understanding. Those who reject God must inevitably be islands of egotism in a sea of separation. Separated by their own choice from God, they are also separated from each other. Two egotisms can come together for a time to exploit each other, but in the end each must repel the other, and by a kind of centrifugal force will move into greater and greater isolation. To be free in this context leads to no benefit or happiness. It is true that such are free from demands made upon them, free from requests for their interest, their concern, their efforts or their aid, free from duties, obligations and restrictions, free among the dead. We cannot conceive what this would entail, what an eternity of separation would imply, or what the frustration of such freedom would be. To be created for the total, but live off the partial, made to find rest in the illimitable, but pinned down by its own chosen limits, to be destined to be invaded completely by the love of God, but to be alone in the hard centre of egotism, must be a frustration beyond imagining. The words, "I would, but thou wouldst not," were spoken in a voice broken by divine tears. Here we must leave this real but appalling possibility and keep in our minds what we also know for certain, that God lovingly invites all men into his kingdom, that such a disaster need come to no one unless he wish it, and that as long as we want it, eternity is ours, now and forever.